welcome back to Chapters at a Time. I'm your host, Mason, here with our other host, Sam.
Hello.
And today we're covering the second and third sections of Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel.
That's right.
So, Sam, you were pretty down on that first section. You didn't love it. What do you think about the second?
It's not that I didn't love it. It was just there were a lot of questions being asked, and there wasn't a lot of clarity of where the story was going, except for the very end of the first chapter, where he started hearing music in the forest, and then some guy who is an imposter pretending to be a priest showed up. I believe he said his name was Father Roberts.
Father Roberts, yep.
And then he just kind of ran off into the woods, or ran away, and then that was it. So I was really confused at where Edward's story was going to go, what the significance of the music was, and just the direction that the story was going to take, especially with a huge time jump. Because normally you could attach to yourself to a character and be like, okay, I can understand, like, we got some backstory on Edward. But it just seemed like we were going over Edward's entire life, and then he wasn't really going to be reintroduced, just based on, like, looking at the chapters that are in the book and the years that they take place. Because I think that took place in 1912. Chapter 2 takes place in 2020. I believe Chapter 3 takes place in 2221. And then after that, I think it takes a time jump another 200 years into the future to 2401. And then it works its way back down. So I was just confused at where the story was going to go. I don't know how you felt.
Yeah, we both definitely had those concerns about how are we going to tie this in. And gosh, even mentions this in Chapter 3 where she had some fan come up to her and be like, oh, I thought you had all of these different character lines that were all going to come together in the end, and yeah, they just didn't. I didn't get it.
Yeah.
And I'm reading this line and I'm like, Emily St. John Mandel, are you messing with me right now?
That's exactly what I thought too. Whenever I read that, I was like, holy, it's like she's breaking the fourth wall with the reader.
Yeah.
Because I think that's exactly what we're going to get out of this. And I'm okay with that, but it was just after the first chapter, I had nothing to latch onto with where things were going to go in a clear sense. I was intrigued, though. I wanted to keep reading, but it was just kind of like, okay, what are we doing here, folks?
We did call the time travel thing from jump. Absolutely. But did you think that the thing that was going to tie in every chapter was going to be the violin notes and the whatever you want to call this thing?
I thought so to some degree. Like, I assumed that there was some phenomena in the forest on the island by Kayet, I think they call it, on Vancouver Island. I thought it either had to do with some, like, temporal anomaly in that region, or whether it had to deal with the father, of course, like Father Roberts, whether he would be, like, a reoccurring character. But in the beginning of the second chapter, it's the violin music that really, like, brings things together at the very beginning.
And even the third, at the end of the third
that's
section.
Right, exactly. So I think it's interesting. I'm not quite sure quite yet what the music represents. Obviously, we don't know what the music is exactly. But I'm curious to know, like, maybe what the underlying message or the symbolism behind it is. But yeah, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're both thinking along the same lines here. And we can go ahead and dive into the plot of the, because I have so much to say about what the point of this book is.
Yeah.
Especially since she does really, you know, break the third wall, and it just opens up so much discussion as to who is Emily St. John Mandel as a person and how much is she projecting into this story. I didn't want to talk about this right now, but she even says at the end of the third section, whenever she's talking to Roberts, that she doesn't like to involve anecdotes from her personal life into books. At least the author that is having the last book tour on Earth, who seems to be a direct parallel to the actual author, who says, oh, you know, this isn't a projection of my life in the book, but it seems very much like it is a projection of her life.
I don't know enough about Emily St. John Mandel's personal life to say that, but obviously she wrote the book around COVID. Pandemics,
a lot of pandemic talk.
Pandemics pop up in the book. I don't know if she's an author. In the third chapter, there's an author figure who's giving her, providing insights as to what it's like to be an author, like getting asked crass questions. that she really doesn't care to entertain, or just being away from family, and just, it's just a part of the job, so she doesn't love doing it, but she has to do it. So I do think she maybe put some of herself in the book, but I don't know enough about her to say that, but I definitely think the case could be made. I would just have to look further into who she is.
Yeah, I think we got to do that before the next episode.
Absolutely, because like I think the notes and the anecdotes that she includes in the third chapter specifically about the author, I think could be very real and like lived.
Yeah, absolutely. So from the top in section two, we are introduced to Morella.
Yes.
The title of the section is Morella and Vincent, so of course we expect to see both of them. And Morella's sitting at this show watching this kind of indie artist who has a very awful following deliver a show in New York where it's music behind several clips of video. Of course, one of the clips of video is his sister, Vincent, who experienced something similar to what Edwin experienced. And, of course, it's also in Vancouver.
In Kayette, specifically.
Or Kayette, specifically, right.
But the Kayette's changed. It's no longer like a mystical forest, I don't believe. I think they talk about how it's just kind of like a developed town now at this point, right?
I think it's still pretty small and not incredibly populous, but populated. But yeah. And so then we jump to Morella recalling Vincent through a conversation with her girlfriend. I will say this part was a little confusing to me because she's introduced as a girlfriend. Did you think that meant
romantic interest? I didn't know at first. I thought, because you could just use the friend or the term girlfriend to just talk about a friend, like, oh, one of my girlfriends.
Right.
So I didn't know at first. I actually had to reread this part just to get the timeline correct in my mind of, like, what was happening. Because she was watching a video, then she's talking to her girlfriend, and then she ends up talking about her dead husband. And so then it didn't really seem, or I was just a little bit confused about the line. Or the exact character dynamics. But it is obviously clearly stated later on that this was her romantic girlfriend.
Right. And we get introduced. This is my biggest qualm with this entire section two, is the writing in specifically this page. Because we are introduced to Morella's girlfriend. Morella's girlfriend tells us a story about her
aunt, Jackie.
Yeah. Aunt and uncle. Uncle's having an affair. At the same time, we're bouncing back and forth between Morella's memories, where she recalls having a strong friendship with Vincent, and Vincent's husband, who turns out to be a Ponzi scheme guy, and her ex-husband, who killed himself after he
mistakenly invested in Vincent's husband, who is Jonathan, investment firm, who was running like a $30 billion or $20 or $30 billion Ponzi scheme that nobody knew.
Right. And so from there, so we learn that Vincent was basically excommunicated from Morella and her husband, and there's some little anecdotal story about her working in a bar after cutting her hair and changing her appearance.
Yeah, so basically what ends up happening is our main character within this chapter is Morella. Morella's watching this video of Vincent and her brother at this scene. Then it cuts to her at dinner with her girlfriend, what was her girlfriend's name? Louisa, I think. Louisa is then telling her a story about her aunt Jackie, who had a husband who was having an affair, and her husband decided to put his second family, it wasn't just an affair, but it was like a second family,
right across the street.
He puts them right across the street, and then it ends up coming out, or gets discovered after Jackie ends up discovering that her husband had put a tuition statement for some private school
under the wrong address, right?
Under the wrong AMX statement, or whatever. American Express statement. And then this call requires Morella to then recall Vincent, and then running into Vincent several years ago, and she hasn't seen Vincent in like a decade, working at a bar, and she pretended not to know her. And then we go back to an explanation of her and her husband, I think, right?
Right, because we are delivered the key line from Louisa that if someone works long enough hours, then they can hide anything. And that's what initially plants the seed in Mirella's mind that, okay, maybe Vincent, in fact, was innocent and didn't know anything about what was right. going on.
Because she personally held Vincent accountable because she was her friend for her husband's death, and her husband only killed himself because Vincent's husband, Jonathan, whole Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, heavy stuff here. And so that's how we get to the theater. Basically, all of that was backstory because Mirella is tracking down Paul, who is the artist,
yes.
who is the brother of Vincent.
Yes, or half-brother.
From here, the narrative gets a little bit more clear.
Yeah.
But man, that part was a mess.
The beginning of chapter two was definitely very tangled and jumbled, in my opinion. Just keeping track of the different plot lines, because it happens all very quickly.
Yeah, and after the show, Mirella goes outside to wait for Paul when she's joined by some guy in a fedora that's pretty annoying.
Yeah.
And then I don't even remember what his name is, and she didn't either, so it's not that important.
She just refers to him as the fedora guy.
And then another individual named Gaspari, who has a very odd name, and it's noted that he has an accent that she doesn't quite place.
Yes, and she recalls him as being foreign of some kind, but can't really quite put her finger on it.
Right, and I actually have to plug my mother for this. I was talking to my mom. I have her reading along with us, so we have a fan base of one. Thank you.
And, that's sweet.
And my mother noticed that Gaspari was saying how he was wearing a mask and washing his hands and COVID.
Oh, yeah.
And Mirella is like, I have never heard any of those words. And Gaspari says,
oh, this was back in...
January.
It's only January. So basically, he doesn't want to shake anybody's hands. He's wearing a mask. He's using Purell. And then he's like, oh, there's a new disease coming out of Wuhan. I don't really care. And then Mirella's kind of like, what are you talking about with COVID-19?
Yeah.
And then he's been like, oh yeah, it's only January. So that's already like suspicious as it is.
Right. And I guess you could make a parallel here to, what was it, measles or smallpox with the indigenous people in first chapter, Remittance. And so there's some parallels there. And of course, we're going to see another spark of a pandemic on Earth in the next section.
Chapter 3.
Coming out of where was it? Australia or something?
Australia, yeah.
And so, where do we go from here? Oh, they all decide to go get food at the French restaurant. Mirella's trying to get information about Vincent. Yeah. And we learn that Paul is somewhat estranged from her. She started working on a boat.
Yeah. So I think, she started working on the boat, on a cruise ship specifically. She got some trainings. Basically, after her husband's whole trial and getting, having criminal charges against him, he fled the country and essentially left her. And so she was left on her own. So then she had to make
To Dubai, right?
He went to Dubai. So then he made his own ends meet, or she made her own ends meet by working at the bar and then working on this cruise ship, which then
she supposedly fell off of or died in some way.
She just disappeared.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we hear from Paul, her brother.
So Paul's sleazy. Nobody likes Paul because he's just using his sister, just grasping at any form of relevance. You know, he just wants his art to have some meaning, even though it clearly doesn't. He doesn't even attach any meaning to this clip.
Is that how you read that?
That's how I read it.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think anything about it. I just thought Paul was just like a regular guy who's just like a minor composer dude, but you thought there was like he was monetarily trying to benefit from his sister.
I think I read Paul as the kind of guy who is very self-absorbed but also wow. very shallow in his art, which is why he only has a cult following and no one actually cares about what he does except for the guy in the fedora who's obsessed with him. We learn that Gaspari does not care about him, that this is all a front, and Paul who's not, I don't know, if my sister disappeared, I think that that would be something that I would speak about differently than Paul spoke about if one of my sister's friends came to me asking about it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the whole setup for this, or the dynamics between why Mirella is talking to Paul, or how she finds Paul, is Mirella wants to find Vincent. She can't find Vincent. She talks to a whole bunch of people, tries to look up her through her husband's surname, can't find anything, and then she finds Paul, and then she went to this whole performance knowing that Vincent was dead, but she didn't know why. I think... I just read Paul as just like a regular dude, though, ultimately.
I guess the jury's still out.
I could see what you're talking about, though. I mean, like, an artist trying to grasp for relevancy based on some trauma related to his sister. Like, I could understand that.
Yeah. I don't really have much else to say on that topic. No. But I will say, I ragged on Emily St. John Mandel's writing earlier, but now I will compliment her. And that is, I had some concerns at the beginning of the first section that... since we're jumping in time, we're not really going to develop a story based on the depth of the characters, right? Mm-hmm. It's seemingly impossible unless they all get tied together. And after three sections, we have no tie together other than Gaspari Roberts. And that was a concern of mine. But I think that Emily does a fantastic job of giving us almost like... sneak peeks into just very short windows, like, of time into people.
Exactly. She provides a nice window into people's lives, or a nice, like, glimpse.
She builds them out just enough for you to understand at least...
their motivations.
And the type of person...
they are, yeah.
Yeah. And so I really appreciate that.
But yeah, she goes to dinner, or she goes to get drinks with Paul, Fedora Guy, and...
Gaspari Roberts.
And Gaspari Roberts.
And she gets the... she gets a little upset, leaves, doesn't pay for a drink, says, I don't know who's paying for this, but it's not me. And
yeah, she interrupts some people at dinner. Once she finds the information about, like, oh, Vincent fell off a cruise ship or disappeared, she's like, all right, I'm out of here. This was great. And then she just dips.
And so she goes to a park to gather her thoughts and, you know, compose herself a bit.
Yeah.
Where she is joined by Gaspari.
Yeah.
Who... I'm not fully sure if Gaspari's a real threat, because he even makes the comment about, you know, it's not safe to be in a park as a woman at night. And she's like, yeah, there's nowhere to be safe as a woman at night by yourself. Yeah. And obviously that's a very real issue in America and elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem we... dwell too much on that topic, so I'm not gonna elaborate much further there. But he says something. What does he say to her that really freaks her out? Oh, so Vincent, okay, hold on. It's all coming back to me. Gaspari asks if Vincent ever mentioned the event to Kayette in Kayette to Mirella because he's an investigator. And she says no. And he says, the things we see when we are young sometimes don't stick with us.
I really like that line.
Yeah. Because it stuck with her.
Yeah.
And so our next little subchapter is a flashback to her days in Ojai. But she immediately is freaked out, takes off,
mm-hmm.
knows that she has seen him from her childhood, gets in a cab and goes to this party that she's expected at with Louisa.
Yeah, basically she kind of looks at Gaspari in this yellow light, as she says, and she says, I think I've seen you before. And he's like, what are you talking about? You have no idea. And I'm pretty sure at this point she's like, you were in Ohio. And he's like, what are you talking about, miss? And she's like, I've seen you in Ohio. And then she leaves to this party. And then she starts realizing to herself that she thought she saw him in Ohio back in, I think, in the 1980s. I think, like, 1984 or something.
Something like that.
She had seen him, and she's like, okay, well, clearly this can't be the same guy because he looks identical to the guy back in 1984. So that's a little bit interesting, especially if we're dealing time travel. Like, is this something that's in her past, but like presumably Gatsby Roberts' future? I don't know.
Or at least, yeah, maybe in his future. I can't tell if he's lying. We've that's seen true. Him lie.
That's true. Pretending to
she
be.
She says he's the same age, so unless after she leaves, then he goes back in time to Ohio to try and get her when she's a kid.
Yeah.
Thus, you know, fulfilling the cycle.
And also from this standpoint, it's like, okay, his name's Gatsby Roberts. What was the name of the father in chapter one?
Father Roberts.
Father Roberts. Okay, is that a coincidence? We're dealing with time travel. She thinks she remembers seeing him back in 1984 in Ohio.
Edwin even made a point that he had an accent.
He seemed foreign.
And, yeah, he seemed foreign. So it's the same guy, definitely.
A very far away, or like,
yeah,
far, far away. So clearly, I think that's pretty suspect that, like, Father Roberts, Gatsby Roberts, whatever his name is popping up in multiple locations. Like, I don't think that's a coincidence.
Absolutely not. We get the flashback to Ohio. It's not that long. Essentially, Morella grew up in Ohio and would have to take the bus to some bus stop and then walk
Half a mile back to her house.
Yeah, which went under an overpass, yeah, which already scared her a lot, apparently.
Yeah.
And
understandably.
One day she's walking by and hears all the characters. Did she hear the gunshots? I can't remember if she heard the gunshots.
I think she did.
Yeah. Okay, she hears gunshots. There's two people presumably dead on the ground. There's one guy who's injured and runs away. And yes. Then there's Gasparri, whatever his name is, sitting there with a gun.
Yes, and then he sees her, and then he said, Morella.
Morella.
But she had realized that, oh, she thought to herself, okay, she started rationalizing to herself, clearly he didn't say Morella.
Right.
This is whenever she was a child.
Right.
But as she's getting older, and after she just ran into this guy, I think she starts rethinking those moments, like, did he say Morella? Because I'm pretty sure that's the guy who was at the underpass. And it makes sense that that's like a moment that would stick with her, because I think if you're a child and you watch or hear two people get murdered and you see the crime scene, that's not going to leave you.
Yeah, that's going to be one of those things that sticks with you even if it happens when you're young.
So in my opinion, that's why I think it's in Gatsby's future, just because it's in Morella's past, Gatsby's future, just because Gatsby didn't recognize her. He actually seemed like confounded in whenever I read it, but she seemed to recognize him. But then whenever this whole event takes down, or this whole event in Ohio takes place, he like says Morella, which I think is a natural thing you would do. Like if you see somebody in a place that you wouldn't like expect, like if you're on vacation in Europe and you see somebody who you haven't seen in like 5 years, you'd be like, are you Mason? Yeah. Is that you? I think it's like the natural thing. And so I think that's also the reaction you would have if you don't think you're going to be in Ohio, or you don't think you've seen this person before, but then you do end up seeing this person. Does that make sense?
I think so. And that's a good pickup, because the next section that we'll be covering is called Bad Chickens, which ties back into the question that Olive is asked in the third section whenever someone mentions how she uses the phrase chickens coming home to roost. It's never good chickens coming home to roost. And frankly, that's a really good point. You would think that chickens roosting on your farm would be a good thing.
I would assume so.
But it's always bad chickens.
It's always bad chickens.
And so I think some bad chickens are going to unfold in the next, well, the rest of the book.
That's right. So that pretty much covers all of chapter two.
Almost. There's one key detail, because we return to the party.
Oh, with her girlfriend.
Right. Louisa. And Morella speaks to her on the rooftop. Louisa says something like, oh, let's go get a cabin in the country. Morella is super put off by this, realizes she has no future with Louisa, and she starts talking to a fortune teller.
Yes.
And the fortune teller starts asking generic fortune teller questions, of course, to which they decide to play a game because Morella's not buying it. And it says, it had something
like, you tell me your secret, I'll tell you mine.
Right. And oh yeah, the secret she says is, I want to kill a man.
Yeah, Marilla says that.
Right. And then upon further reflection, she realizes, maybe I want to kill him. Maybe I want
to... just talk to him.
Just talk to him.
Yeah.
And that's Jonathan.
Yeah.
Vincent's ex-husband.
Right. Something that I thought was kind of interesting is what happens between Marilla and Louisa seems to happen very quickly, because it seems like they're a thing. They seem pretty devoted to one another, but then it seems like Marilla just very quickly falls out of love with this person, and it doesn't seem like Louisa gives her a very good reason for that to be the case, because they're on the rooftop, and while they're talking together, she recalls that she had been there before with her husband, over a decade before. I think his name was Fazel?
I think so.
Fazel. And the memories kind of come flooding back to her. And then what I thought was kind of interesting is she makes the note that, she doesn't like to spend a lot of time like dwelling on things or like going back into her memories, because that's a bad place. So it almost seems like she's afraid of what she has experienced or who she was, and she tries to distance herself from that. Or at least that's how I read it, just because she doesn't want to entertain who she previously was or like the memories that she had. And then I think that's interesting compared to quickly falling out of love with somebody that you had been with for like a year, which is not an insignificant amount of time, I would think.
Yeah, I think the best way to understand this from a character arc standpoint is she pushed it off, thinking about all the things that she didn't want to think about for so long.
Yeah.
And then after having this realization with Louisa, then the floodgates are open.
Yeah.
And she can't stop thinking about it, and she's involved in it. And now there's no more running or hiding from it, and it is singularly encapsulating her life.
Right.
And I really hope that we link back up with her.
Yeah, me too. I feel bad for Louisa, though, because it's like Louisa did nothing wrong. And like they say goodbye at the party, and then Marilla makes the comment that she felt nothing whenever they like kiss goodbye or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is... just seems like it happened all very quickly for her.
Yeah.
Anyways.
We'll pour one out for Louisa. That's all I really got for section two. So far, section two is my favorite of the three sections we've read. This something about the way that...
Really?
Yeah, it doesn't happen to me all that much anymore whenever I read books and like hairs stand up.
Mm.
But something about whenever Marilla confronts Gaspari and's like, oh, I know you from somewhere. But before we get the flashback, I just like, I don't know, man. The hairs started standing up, and I was like, ooh, that's kind of spooky. And so, yeah, I really liked section two. Section three, I have more complaints.
You have more complaints about?
About the writing in particular. Because in all of the other subsections, we have these page or two long, or in every other section, we have these 1 to 2 or 1 to 5 page subsections.
Yeah.
This one's just one.
What do you think about that writing style?
Or I like, wish it was consistent.
But do you think potentially, because like with Edward, which lasted I think like 35, 37 pages, we had like 9 different subsections for Edward developing his character.
Right.
In chapter 2 we had I think 3 sections. Yes. Over the course of like the same amount of pages. And then in the third section we have 1, which covers pretty much the same amount. Do you think that could be partially correlated to like the characters themselves?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about it like this.
Because I'm thinking like, okay, maybe she's using different literary tools. The author, of course, is using different literary tools to develop the characters in the different plot lines to potentially make them stand out more to us as we read it.
In terms of, like, relative significance.
Right. And also to make it more, like, significant. So then it's not just, like... because if I were to tell you, like, okay, if you're reading a book and then we're in the year 2000 and then we make a jump to the year 2200, the only thing that distinguishes 2000 from 2200 is me telling you we're going to make a time jump. So do you think she could be using, like, literary devices to make the sections feel more... unique, therefore making the time jump just stand out a little bit more in our mind, or that distinction between the sections?
I think that's a good working theory. I'm interested to see if we have that symmetry, because
it works its way back.
We can't go back, or we can't go down less than one, right?
That's right.
And so section 4, I'm not quite sure how she's going to do that, and if it's going to, yeah, that's something we're going to keep an eye on.
Because we're going to revisit, I don't know what chapter it is, but we end up revisiting the year 2020, and we end up, the year that we go into, 2203, we end up revisiting right after Bad Chickens. So I'll be curious to see how she ends up developing this.
Yeah, and we don't know about the year of Mirella and Vincent. We can guess that the sixth section where we return to Mirella and Vincent, which is titled File Corruption. So therefore, that could have two meanings. The first being that this whole story is being told from the perspective of someone in the year 2401.
Yeah.
And thus, going through archives, there is a file corruption for Mirella and Vincent. Alternatively, we could return specifically to the moment where Vincent experienced the violin tree thing, and that was a literal file corruption whenever it was being videoed.
Mm.
So, I'm interested to see where we go there.
Yeah, me too.
But without a further ado,
chapter three.
The last book tour on Earth. And so we get our third main protagonist, Olive, who, unsurprisingly, is an author, and she's doing a book tour. She goes basically everywhere, and we have really committed to the sci-fi bit in this section. We've got low-orbit aircrafts. We have colonies both on the moon and Titan and Alpha Centauri, and we have... space travel for commuters, holograms, whatever. You name it, we've got it. Including colonizers. Times a flat circle. Now, I hate to say this in the middle of an episode. I meant to lead the episode off with this. So if you guys are following along at home, I'm sorry. But we're going to take a quick digression in between section 2 and section 3. And the point of that is to build suspense for section 3. Not at all, because this is unplanned. Previously, we covered a book titled No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy.
That's right.
However, our audio at the time was very bad, and going back and editing all of it would be a lot of work. So I do not think I'm going to publish that at this point in time, and I'm telling Sam all of this live.
Wow.
so we maybe will publish that later in the future, but this is effectively our first published book. And so I did say this in the first book when we were covering No Country for Old Men, but we are both physicists, at least in the...
Aspiring.
Aspiring, right. So we're PhD students in physics, and that's where I have my bone to pick. And that's with Alpha Centauri. Because it is not at all possible. I mean, unless you have the Alcubierre warp drive going. In 2200, for us to develop colonies on Alpha Centauri. Alpha Centauri is 3 light years away.
Yeah, it's not happening. Well, unless you have warp drive technology. That's the only way that you
which
can...
we clearly don't.
Yet,
I guess. But, okay, let's assume we don't have faster than light travel.
This is your problem? Well, technically, warp drive's not faster than light, because...
It kind of is.
You don't travel faster than light within
the... Within your local rest frame, whatever. Yeah,
but, so technically you're not traveling faster than light.
Okay, whatever, we'll talk about that later. But, anyways, my point is, in order for something to go at the speed of light, it must be massless. Considering we're not going to significantly alter the mass of humans, because that would be not good for the humans, we can only reasonably expect like 1% the speed of light, which is so far ahead of what we have right now. Meaning, it would take 300 years just to get there, much less to build a colony. So, what? I sat there for a minute, closed the book, and I was like, is this in any way feasible without a warp drive?
I don't mean to attack you, Mason, but we're dealing with a book where the central premise of the book is time travel.
Which hasn't even been invented in 2200.
Right, it has not been invented in 2203 or whatever it is. But the main motivation of the book is time travel. And if time travel is possible, then you get into a whole lot of problems with, like, the grandfather paradox, like, all sorts of stuff. Cause and causality, lots of problems. And your main problem is they settled a star system 3 light years away. Like, your problem is with the physics of them getting there, and you're not even, like, gonna use that same analysis on, oh, how does a person go back in time? Like, because we could...
I guess you're right.
Because, like, in theory, if you and I want to go into the future, we could go into the future in a figurative sense. If you and I travel near the speed of light,
sure,
we're in our own inertial, like, reference frame.
Yeah.
We go circle around a black hole for, like, 15 years, have a good time, party, watch movies, whatever, come back to Earth.
Don't do it, Murph!
Exactly. Exactly like Interstellar. Like, that's possible, but going back in time, that's a whole different problem. But the hill you want to die on...
I'll die on both hills, now that you mentioned. I'll die twice. Okay, alright. Digression ended. We'll get back to section 3. Sam has a really good point. Okay. But, tying this back in with No Country for Old Men, Olive's last name is Llewellyn.
That's right.
And she does make a pit stop in Texas, and basically everywhere else. But yeah, what'd you think about section 3?
I thought if there was anything that was on the nose relating to the author, I thought this chapter was it, just because we're dealing with an author who's complaining about the problems with being an author, which I do believe are true, and, like, these are real problems. I'm not an author, but I assume these are very real.
I bet it's taxing.
It's a different lifestyle that I cannot relate to. And then this is also where we focus a little bit more on the whole, like, pandemic talk, and it's like an active thing going on within this world at this time within the book. And there's some virus coming out of Australia. They think it's contained. They're not really sure. And people are kind of angsty about the whole thing. So I thought chapter 3 maybe related more to the author. But I liked it overall. And I thought it was, like, an interesting read. It being one solid section compared to the 3 sections before and then the 9 sections before that did throw me off a little bit, just because I was expecting, like, short excerpts and, like, insights into a person's life over a longer period of time, but that wasn't the case.
One thing that I saw a lot of reflection, which I'm sure if Emily has any children, has dealt with this on book tours, where we repeatedly have misogynistic comments made towards Emily about, oh, I bet you must feel awful for not being home taking care of your child, or that's so nice of your husband to take care of your child while you're away.
Right. Basically, Olive's asked, like, these exact questions on her book tour, and
what is an expectation for her is, like, graciousness or a favor being done by her husband.
And then I think obviously Olive points out a good question, like, oh, she pretends not to hear the question. And then she essentially says, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you said that I should be thankful that my husband's taking care of his own child. Which...
Yeah. And in the same vein, she never says a positive word about her man back home. What's his name? Did you catch his name?
I don't remember.
But yeah, she never says a single nice thing to or about her husband, which... I don't want to assume the sexuality of our beloved author, but it makes you wonder if you're her husband. You're like, hey, how much of this are you projecting?
I don't know.
So, yeah, there's quite a few things that she mentions, like, where she says, I'm just trying to write an interesting book. There is no message.
Yeah.
Where it really makes... hard work for us podcasters about what's your message, Emily.
Well, my response to that would be is maybe the author is not aware of their own motivation behind writing a story, so maybe it's more subconscious. So she doesn't think there's a message, but clearly, like, something influenced her, and the influence is the underlying message, I would say.
And maybe the real meaning behind art is whatever you personally get out of it.
I mean, ultimately, yeah.
Ultimately. So, she's bouncing around, finding questions annoying and traveling tiring and all of these things. Did you take any... What do you think the symbolism is behind her talking about the colors of the inside of the hotels? She talks about that on, like, three different occasions. And I was trying so hard to... Is it just, like, a Groundhog Day effect? Is that what you're thinking, where it all runs together and...
I don't know. I think she ends up spending all of her time in hotels. I haven't really thought about this. But I assume she spends all of her time in hotels and she's just traveling along. And so even though she's going all these cool places, it's not like she's really traveling to these places because she ends up staying in the same kinds of buildings. And so the only thing that she's able to differentiate between city to city or planet to planet or location to location is the color of the walls in the hotels, which is kind of striking. Because you would think if you go from like Saturn's moon Titan and then you're on the moon and then you go to Earth, like, you would think that, like, that's pretty impressive just talking about it, and then you would think there's a lot to see and look at and, like, marvel at, but all she is able to see due to her busy schedule is the walls of the hotel. And so I would liken that to people who go on, like, business trips and travel. And they'll
travel. It must be so nice to travel for work.
Right. You get to go to so many cool places. What have you seen? And they're like, nothing. I was doing business. And then
I've seen the AC Marriott bar.
Right. And then I flew home because I missed my family. Like, my father used to do a lot of, like, international business and, like, travel around. But he did nothing in the locations just because he would be there for a while doing business. It's not like he's sightseeing or anything.
Yeah, you're not paid to vacation.
No.
So... we also learn that Olive Lulin was born on a moon colony.
That's right.
And so, this is her first time on Earth, I believe.
It might be.
And this is for her book tour of the book, Marinbad.
Yes.
She had written two books previously.
That did not go over so well.
Right.
Did not get past limited publishing on Earth.
Right. And Marinbad's a hit. And let's see, what was I going to say about that? We do learn that our boy Gaspari Roberts, who naturally shows up at the very end of the chapter like he has in the other two.
Well, I mean...
he's named after a character in her book.
Kind of. I didn't take it to be the same Gaspari that we've seen before.
You didn't think so?
No, because he introduces himself as Gaspari Jacques, who is a person within her book. So, in this book, Marinbad...
Oh, come on. He asks her about the thing. It has to be the same Roberts.
I think it could be somebody of the same relation, like family, like son, daughter, father, brother, something along those lines.
My brother is Jacques Gaspari, not just OG Gaspari.
I think it's a different one, like, because we got Father Roberts. Clearly, the guy's not afraid of using his name. Then we got... Gaspari Roberts, and now we have Gaspari Jacques. So I thought it was just a different Gaspari, just
I think
a Jacques edition.
I think he's doing a Bond, James Bond thing across centuries. He's like Bond in the first section, James Bond in the second,
sure,
and now James Jacques Bond in the third. So,
although it would make sense because in this section, or within Chapter 3, there's the new pandemic on Earth in Australia that everybody's a little bit afraid of. So if the guy was afraid of, or from this time period, and there's a pandemic that does negatively influence humankind at this point, and then he travels, for some reason, time travels back to another pandemic, it would make sense that he would be, like, more alarmed about what's going on in Wuhan. I don't know. I took it to be two different characters. I didn't read it as another one. Although, for continuity sense, it would make sense, but I don't know. I need more evidence.
I'm team, this is the same guy. I don't know if she made a I think she did make a comment about the accent as well. But I, don't quote me on that. So, while we're talking about this, and there's really not all that much to this section, it's really just her at various book events talking about her home life and missing her home. She does have some commentary about how parents become kind of more self-interested after retirement because her parents moved to wherever, and then...
Oh, yeah. Her parents moved away.
Oh, yeah. They're like, oh, you're so far away. And she's like, you guys are the ones that moved.
Yeah. I personally felt I could relate to this because I was living in a region. And then as soon as I graduated high school and went to college, my parents immediately moved away. And now that a narrative within my family is, oh, why do you live so far away? And it's like, dude, you're the one that moved.
So, yeah, I think that's kind of a one-off thing that she just wanted to highlight of like, I guess this happens to a lot of people.
Yeah. Which, understandably, you spend 18 years raising a person, then all of a sudden you're kind of like, oh, now I can spend some time focusing on me.
Right.
I get it. But something else that's really big in Chapter 3 is the conversation she has with her husband. Because what does her husband do?
Oh, he's a architect?
He's an architect, but he's working on a project.
For the physics building.
Yes. And it seems kind of suspicious to him about its, like, layout.
It has a bunch of tunnels underground from the physics building to security headquarters.
Yeah, some government building. And they think it's related to time travel. Or she thinks it's related to
because
time travel.
Because what is time travel if not a gigantic security concern?
Right, that's a good quote from the book. So it seems like her husband is working on this project that is related to time travel because time travel has not yet been figured out, as we talked about earlier.
And if it has, it's classified.
Right. Which is also kind of funny because he's just telling his wife about this, which I don't think that's how security clearances work. Especially, presumably...
Over the phone?
Over the phone, exactly. They're not even, like, in a secure environment.
So, yeah, who knows? I would like to be there, narratively speaking, when they invent time travel. I would be willing to bet that we will not be there whenever they invent time travel. But
if it's possible.
No, I don't mean like you and I.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean in the book. Like, oh. I would like to see the scene or at least have something going on whenever it is invented. But I get the feeling that the bad chickens that are coming home to roost are going to be the various Fallout events from people time traveling in the years between 2200 and 2401.
Yeah.
So,
which, I mean, who could imagine that could happen? Like, you can
time
travel.
Who would have
like,
thought of that?
Who would have ever
only
thought that,
every
that could be a
movie
problem
in the last century? So, that's basically it. One scene that I really liked was when she was in Cape Town, and she sees the lights and she hears the string quartet and she thinks to herself, this is one of the glamorous moments. Knowing she has to return home to a life that it doesn't seem, because she even says she wants to be alone, doesn't seem she actually is that excited to return to her life. It seems like she is excited to return to her daughter. But that feeling, you know, when you have something kind of hanging over your head or a sense of dread generally, and you look around and you feel, oh, this is the good part.
This is...
Man, it just, like, tears at the heartstrings. So I really liked that moment because, personally, I've been there, I think. Not to talk about us too much, but yeah. During our 20s, working on a PhD, it's like, oh, this is the good part.
They exist. That's surprising.
This is the good part, I see. And, anyways. So other than that, one last super crucial topic of conversation that we touched on a minute ago is when, at the end of the chapter, her publicist introduces her to an interviewer from Philly, our Gaspari Jacques Roberts. And apparently in the book Marin Bad, she has a scene in the Oklahoma City something or another.
Air terminal or something.
Air terminal or whatever. And that is at least very reminiscent of the violin playing near the tree.
Mm.
And Gasparri asks her if she's ever experienced something like that. And in the previous chapter, he did establish himself as an investigator.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm inclined to believe that this is just another event he's investigating. And she says, I don't like to write from personal experience, which is another wrench in the works, which we've already talked about. But then we do not get to hear that conversation, unfortunately. But she indicates that something like that did occur.
Mm.
And she is willing to talk to him about it off the record. And that begs the question, did it happen in OKC? Or did this happen at a different time when she was at Kayette? Is it just this one instance? Because in the past, we're inclined to believe that it only happens in Kayette.
So if this guy's like, so you're saying like things are temporal, anomalies are happening at different locations throughout time and at different locations?
Possibly. I'm asking what you think. Because she says she only kind of tangentially writes from experience. But did we ever see her go to anywhere in the Pacific Northwest?
No. She didn't. At the very least, she didn't visit Vancouver or Kayette, at the very least.
And
maybe?
This is her first time on Earth. So it has to be more widespread.
So assuming you're right, in this Gatsbury Jacques is the same as Gatsbury Roberts, which is not that far of a leap, but assuming they're the same guy, do you think this guy is just like going, is like some kind of investigator witnessing, or not witnessing, but investigating these different like anomalies that people have experienced?
I think the bad chickens came home to roost, and now everyone in 2400 is trying to close the gaps. And I think the invention of time travel has somehow torn the fabric of the space-time continuum in this world, and they're trying to patch it all up. So he's investigating it, going back in time, shooting people that are time travelers before they can open holes. And yeah, that's what I think happens.
Wow.
You like that theory?
It's a dark theory, but yeah, why not? Sounds cool.
Yeah, it's like, you ever seen Looper?
Looper? No, I don't think
I have. It's got Joseph Gordon-Levitt in it.
No, I haven't seen that.
That's an awesome movie. I'm going to talk about that just for a second before we sign off. Unless Sam has a whole lot more talking points, because I'm kind of out. But Looper's a sweet movie. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you basically sign this deal with the mafia in the future, and you kill people, and they can't punish the mafia in the future for it. And then the people in the future can, due to inflation, give you a bunch of money, and you have to kill yourself to close your loop, but the money to them is worthless, but it's a fortune to you now. And people, aka Joseph Gordon-Levitt, doesn't want to kill himself. The person that comes back in time from the future with all the money
just stays.
And well, I guess you'll have to watch the movie and find out. Good movie, though. So, yeah, that's basically all I got today.
That's all I have as well. What do you think about the writing style of the author? Do you like what she's doing more now? I will have to say, I'm definitely more invested in the book by this point.
Yeah, I think it's a good book.
Me too. I'm curious to see how all the plot lines are going to come together or not come together. In the book that we did read before this, No Country for Old Men, a lot of open-ended questions. It didn't really resolve itself very well. If that ends up happening here, I wouldn't be too upset. I think leaving mystery or some things left unanswered is more of like a treat to the reader.
You wouldn't be upset?
No, I wouldn't be upset. I think it can be a treat to the reader because then it allows them to like project themselves more into the story, and then they get to decide how things end for themselves.
All right, Sam, I got a question for you then.
Sure.
Do you think that if someone is self-aware of their negative qualities, that that absolves them of the effect of the negative quality?
I think it makes it better, but it does not absolve them. I think, like, if you know what your negative qualities are, I think that's a good thing, because then you can work towards, like, lessening, or, like, you can focus on those and try to, like, dampen the impacts they may have on other people or have on yourself. But I don't think that that excuses you.
Well, I'm talking to you one-on-one right now, Emily St. John Mandel. You know that your audience doesn't like it, as you wrote in section 3, when you don't connect the characters. So you are self-aware that you're causing detriment to your audience by not connecting characters. If you don't connect these characters, you will not be absolved in my mind. But I do really enjoy the book. You're doing a great job. Keep up the fantastic work.
I think that's a good place to leave it.
All right. Well, until next week, keep on reading out there. And we'll be covering section 4. Hopefully it's not section 4 and 5 next week. Sorry about that. But
we'll see. Yeah.
We'll see. No promises.